Well, that was fun. I haven't gotten to do that in a while. And it's fun playing with my kids. Well, they keep getting married, so I don't know if we can call it the Shea Band anymore. There's three Shays left, so when Ruben gets married, it'll be the two Shays. Okay, Hosea chapter 9, and we'll continue our study. Hosea was a prophet to the northern kingdom. He oversaw the fall of the northern kingdom, just as Jeremiah oversaw the fall of the southern kingdom. And when we read Ephraim or Israel, we're talking about the northern kingdom. Remember, the nation Israel split in two. The 10 northern tribes we call Israel, the 2 southern tribes we call Judah. They both end up falling and being hauled away. Hosea's ministry, to get the timing, began in about 780 BC. And he was a prophet until the northern kingdom fell in 722 BC. So 780 to 722, you get the picture there. What is that, 60 years? 50, 60 years? Last time, we saw that every time God wanted to heal Israel, and he wanted to, their sin and rejection sort of opened up to a new page. I want to come and heal you guys, but there's more. More stuff that you guys are doing that's just wicked. And as they pursued these ungodly things, and it describes them as being in heated pursuit. Remember the baker, the story of the baker? They would do these religious actions on the side. I want to go do this, and I'm heated about it, but you know what? I was raised Jewish, and we go to Sabbath every day, and we do this worship at the temple, even though there's a dumb golden calf in it now, but we worship God. And they would go through their religious routines, and God's saying, your religion is dead. It's meaningless to me because it's not, I want your heart. I don't want your works. And I love the illustration, the unturned pancake illustration. Remember that one? Where God says, you guys are like an unturned cake. You know, if you have a pancake and you're cooking it on the grill and you just keep cooking it and you don't turn it, one side gets black and the other side's raw. Anybody want that? You want to pour your syrup on that? No thanks. You're going to toss it. He says, you guys are like an unturned pancake because the side that's cooking, that's hot, that's your passion. That's your desire. Those are the things you're chasing after. They're not. It's not God you're chasing after. Those are your things you're chasing after. The uncooked side is the God side. They're trying to live in both worlds, but they're only focusing on the one world. And so they're like an uncooked pancake. One of their unwise actions, and I know that in the United States today, we cannot relate to this. Oops, I was not supposed to get political. I already did. I'm in my intro and I already got political. Sorry. Was that they're setting up kings and princes, meaning government leaders, and they're not seeking the Lord and who those people should be. They're picking the people that they wanted. And the kings that they picked liked the wickedness that was going on. They approved of the wickedness of the people. And then lastly, it says they had sown to the wind, but now they're going to reap the whirlwind. Or they had, you know, the wind blows by and you kind of can't see it. And I'm just going to sow to the air. And, oh, it feels good. And let's all love each other and love our cats and, you know, be hippies, kind of. I have my son in the front row, and he's one of my best critics. Elizabeth is the best critic, but she's way back there. I can't hear. But Ruben's, like, giving me feedback. Like, you're losing it, Dad. They sow to the wind. You know, you guys remember laughing, ooh, and the flowers and everything. And they're reaping. A whirlwind's a tornado. They're reaping the tornado. Tornado's destructive and scatters things. So that's what Israel's doing. They're sowing to meaningless stuff, and they're reaping destruction. Now, as we go through this encouraging, uplifting book of Israel's fall, why is this good for us? Because Israel does a lot of things that, or I should say, we do many of the things that Israel does. Israel's going sideways in numerous ways. And we can look at Israel, the nation Israel, think of them as a person, and look at our own hearts. What are we doing? And so when we see the mistake that Israel's going through, and then we see the judgment that they're reaping from the Lord, it should give us cause to respond, to take it to heart. We have a choice. In Proverbs, it says the fool doesn't see it all and just rejects it. But the wise man listens and will change. And that's the challenge that we're faced as we go through Hosea. We can read about them and say, aren't they awful? Look how terrible they were, and learn nothing. Or we can look at them and apply what we see to our lives, those nuggets that fit our lives, and make those changes. So we start off in chapter 9, verse 1. Do not rejoice, O Israel, with joy like other peoples, for you have played the harlot against your God. You have made love for hire on every threshing floor. The threshing floor and the winepress shall not feed them, and the new wine shall fail in her. So at the time of this prophecy, it may be that Israel was kind of doing okay financially, economically. They had big crops, and it could be that they're at a feast. And, oh, let's hear from the prophet Hosea. And he stands up, and he sees these guys partying and rejoicing, and you've got plenty, and everything is looking great. And he says, hey, you guys, don't rejoice like the other nations, because God is telling us you're going to fall because of your sin. You're playing the harlot. The harlotry on the threshing floor and the wine press, well, that's where the crops would come in. And they would often do idol worship there, hoping for a bountiful crop. Let's worship Baal here and do a sacrifice at the threshing floor. Maybe he'll bring us more grain. We'll have a bigger crop. And God sees that as harlotry. You're being unloyal to me. You're my bride. I'm your husband. And you're going out and messing around with others. They shall not dwell in the Lord's land, but Ephraim shall return to Egypt and shall eat unclean things in Assyria. Remember, Egypt is where Israel came from. Egypt represents the world. Assyria is the country that's going to come and haul them away captive. Verse 4, they shall not offer wine offerings to the Lord, nor shall their sacrifices be pleasing to him. It shall be like bread of mourners to them. All who eat it shall be defiled, for their bread shall be for their own life. It shall not come into the house of the Lord. So here we have a prophecy that Israel is soon going to be taken captive, and they're going to be led out of the promised land that God gave them. And at first, their captivity is described as returning to Egypt. And this shows the nature of what's happening to Israel. Some of them did flee to Egypt, but most of them went to Assyria. But by returning to Egypt, what does he represent? We just said it like a minute and a half ago. I forget my sermons from last Sunday, but you guys need to remember the point for at least a minute and a half. Egypt represents the world. They're returning to the world. They were slaves in Egypt. They're returning to slavery in the world. They've chosen the world, the secular life, for themselves. They're returning to it. So at first it's described as returning to Egypt. And of course, God said, you'll never go that way again. Excuse me. But they're going that way again because they've left God. Now, in verse 3b, we see that Israel will be dwelling in Assyria and will be eating unclean and unkosher food as captives. Now, some of this little section you don't get unless you understand Israeli culture, their background. In verse 4, it says they have no food for making sacrifices, only enough food for survival. They're supposed to go and make sacrifices to the Lord, but they don't have enough to do that. They're barely living on what they have left. Not only that, the altars are going to be gone. There's no place to go and offer sacrifices. It says, it shall be like bread of mourners to them. All who eat it shall be defiled. Having no proper way to present an offering to the Lord makes the offering defiled. It's not done according to how Moses said you should do it. And if you partake of that offering, you become defiled spiritually. It takes you 7 days to be clean again, to be ceremonially clean. And so these guys that are doing the works and going and worshiping the Lord, because that's their family history, but their hearts are far from it, God's going to remove that whole thing. You guys are going to be hauled away where there's nowhere to do these offerings that you're doing wrongly. And not only that, if you try to do them, the offering that you're trying to gain acceptance by the Lord is actually going to make you defiled in his presence. So he's really dealing with this wrong type of offering. And this is a key observation for us, because as people, especially in an affluent country like the United States, where we can do whatever we want, we tend to make a God that we want. you know, this one has too many things that I shouldn't do. I want to do this. Here's the list that I'm going to keep. My God thinks like this. Sorry about your God. You know, whatever our gods think like is irrelevant. What matters is what God thinks like. My brother told a story. Reuben, I'm going to divert a little bit. My brother was speaking up in Alaska at a mayor's conference. I was really kind of jazzed that he got to do that, you know. And he did this neat story. He kind of impressed me. And he came up and said, you know, the moose up here are just gorgeous. And we saw moose at our hotel. And, you know, they walk around all over up there. So we'd drive to school, and we lived up there, and we'd see four or five moose on the way to school almost every morning. And these guys are big. They're bigger than here. And it's dark in the winter, so you got the black moose out on the road that's plowed because it's easier than walking through the snow. And you got the dark moose, you're going down the highway fast. And they had a sign that said, moose kills this year. And it's like 100 and something. You know, anyhow. He says, you know, my idea of a moose is this big, gorgeous rack. And the moose bull standing up there on the hill with the mountains in the background and the sun, and he just looks majestic. That's my moose. And his wife and his daughters, they love horses. And their moose, you know, you get the horse and you can rub its nose and they're kind of, you pet them. It's a cold day and you can hug the fur and get close and pet them and they're really neat. And their moose is kind of cuddly and rub their nose. And so they walk out of the hotel and there's a baby moose. Oh! And the girls start to go towards the baby moose. So cute. And out from behind the bushes comes Mama Moose. Oh! And Mama Moose comes down, her ears go back, and she's looking at him. Oh, what's going to happen? It's not important what the girl's moose was or what my brother's moose was. What's important is what the moose's moose was. That mother moose was going to tear him apart. And so when we make up our own God, it's not important what you think your God is. I meet with my God in nature. Well, he made it. That's cool. But that's not your church. God says, go to church. Gather with the saints. So what matters is God's God. And Israel is making their own God. We'll go do this offering, and then we forget about him the rest of the week. And God's saying, I'm stopping that. I'm hauling you away to Assyria to stop that wicked activity that you're doing. Verse 5. What will you do in the appointed day, meaning on that feast day, when you're supposed to go and offer the feast, but there's no more place to do that? What will you do in the appointed day and in the day of the feast of the Lord? For indeed they are gone because of destruction. The places are gone to worship the Lord. Egypt shall gather them up. Memphis, a city in Egypt, shall bury them. Nettles shall possess their valuables of silver. Thorns shall be in their tents. All these places of pagan worship are going to disappear. The days of punishment have come. The days of recompense have come. Israel knows. So they've been denying that these days are going to come. Their false prophets have been saying, oh, peace and prosperity. We saw that in Judah also before King Nebuchadnezzar came and hauled them away. That's all going to be great. Don't worry about it. But he says, the days of recompense have come, past tense, meaning for certain, God is finally going to come and judge you guys. And you're going to know why. Because I've been telling you. The prophet is a fool. The spiritual man is insane because of the greatness of your iniquity and great enmity. Now, this one has two views regarding what this section could mean. And I think they're probably both correct. One view is that the people were saying, Hosea, you're insane. You're nuts. All you're prophesying is doom and gloom. He wasn't prophesying what they wanted to hear. The other view is that the false prophets would eventually be exposed as being fools and insane. They've been saying, peace, peace, prosperity. Don't worry about it. This area is not going to be a problem. When Assyria hauls them all away, they're going to look at those false prophets and go, you insane fools. Could be one or the other, or it could be both. Verse 8, the watchman of Ephraim is with my God, but the prophet is a fowler's snare in all his ways, enmity in the house of his God. They are deeply corrupted, as in the days of Gibeah. He will remember their iniquity. He will punish their sins. The fowler snare, a fowler is a guy that would catch birds, and he'd have a snare to catch them. And so he's saying, prophets, you're like fowler snares. The religious leaders were catching and killing the people spiritually, leading them the wrong way. In the same way that the fowler snare catches a bird. Now, what was their defense, the people, of not being caught? Anybody have a guess on what their defense might have been? You know, what could they have done to not get caught by the fake guys? Go to God's word. God's word would have showed them. You're not supposed to be worshiping a dumb calf. But apparently, they chose to be blind. They are deeply corrupted, as in the days of Gibeah. Now, we're going to look at what happened in the days of Gibeah. We're going to look at this. But he's talking about the false teachers being deeply, not just a little bit, deeply corrupted. And the level of corruption is compared to whatever that sin was that happened in Gibeah. Now, if you want to choose a city of great sin, who's it going to be? Come on, this is like a first grade question. Sodom and Gomorrah, right? What happened in Sodom? The angels came. Hey, we'll tell Abraham what we're going to do. Hey, if there's, you know, 10 people there, will you not destroy? Yeah, if there's 10 people, we won't destroy the city. And they go down. The angels go to Lot's house. And they go inside, and what happened? Sorry? Remember, the city came and said, the men came, give us your visitors. We want to have sex with them. Yuck. That was the level that Sodom had fallen. So you could say they were gay activists in the city of Sodom, going after these angels, these guys. The sin that occurred in Gibeah is recorded in Judges 19. We had a Levite, he's traveling, and he's traveling from Bethlehem, going back up north, and he comes to Gibeah, the town. It's in Benjamin's region, and he needs to lodge for the night. I'm in Judges 19, verse 15. And when he went in, he sat down in the open square of the city, for no one would take him into his house to spend the night. Just then an old man came in from his work in the field at evening, who also was from the mountains of Ephraim, same place that this Levite was from. He was staying in Gibeah, whereas the men of the place were Benjaminites. And when he raised his eyes, he saw the traveler in the open square of the city, and the old man said, "Where are you going, and where do you come from?" So he said to him, "We are passing from Bethlehem in Judea toward the remote mountains of Ephraim. I am from there. I went to Bethlehem in Judah, now I am going to the house of the Lord, but there is no one who will take me into his house. Although we have both straw and fodder for our donkeys and bread and wine for myself, for your female servant, and for the young man who is with your servant, there is no lack of anything. I can feed ourselves and I can feed you guys if you'll take us in." And the old man said, "Peace be with you. However, let all your needs be my responsibility. Only do not spend the night in the open square." So he brought him into his house and gave fodder to the donkeys, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. He's being a good host. Now here's the crime. As they were enjoying themselves, suddenly certain men of the city, perverted men, surrounded the house and beat on the door. They spoke to the master of the house, the old man, saying, "Bring out the man who came to your house, that we may know him carnally." Yuck. What's the difference between these guys and Sodom? Nothing. So the sin of Gibeah was these debased hearts of the people coming, and they're aggressive. They've fallen this far. Verse 23, "But the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, 'No, my brethren, I beg you, do not act so wickedly. Seeing this man has come into my house, do not commit this outrage.'" Now this part I don't get. "Look, here's my virgin daughter and the man's concubine. Let me bring them out now. Humble them and do with them as you please, but to this man do not do such a vile thing." But the men would not heed him. So the man took his concubine and brought her out to them, and they knew her and abused her all night until morning. And when the day began to break, they let her go. Then the woman came as the day was dawning and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was till it was light. When her master arose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go his way, there was his concubine fallen at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. And he very kindly and gently said to her, "Get up, let's be going." What a turkey. But there was no answer. She had died. And you know, if we read on, it gets worse. The story gets even more gruesome. This is that wonderful message that I taught one Mother's Day. So the guy who got up his concubine and sent pieces to all the tribes of Israel because the sin was so evil. And all the tribes of Israel came and attacked Gibeah and almost entirely wiped out all the men of the tribe of Benjamin. They thought that sin was so terrible. That's how they reacted. So back in Hosea chapter 9, verse 9, they're described, the religious leaders are deeply corrupted, as in the days of Gibeah. So the similar type of corruption. Homosexuality is going on. They've fallen that far. He will remember their iniquity. He will punish their sins. Verse 10, I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your fathers as the first fruits on the fig tree in its first season. So God's fondly remembering them in their early days as a nation. He found them. He chose them. They were like grapes in the wilderness. You don't find that all the time. Grapes in the wilderness is kind of unusual. If you're out there on a hike in the wilderness, remember it's all desert and just rock there, and you find grapes, you're going to go, oh, yeah, these are going to taste great. You're thirsty and you need food and it's fresh right off the vine. Or the first fruits of the fig tree, brand new fig tree. Oh, it gave fruit this year. Neat. And you find it and you treasure it. That's how God felt about Israel. Unfortunately, we have a but. But they went to Baal Peor and separated themselves to that shame. They became an abomination like the thing they loved. Now, we have another illustration here. Baal of Peor. But the key thing is not really the sin. The key thing is that they separated themselves. I'm in relationship with God, but I'm going to separate myself now and leave God. And I'm going to go toward this thing that I really want. I'm going to set God aside in my heart. Now, the sin of Baal Peor is another historical event. God was leading those wilderness grapes and first season figs to the promised land. He was leading Israel to the promised land. They were going up the King's Highway, which is on the other side of the Jordan. Here's the Jordan River right there. And so they came up, and the King's Highway runs up through the nation Jordan. And so they're way down here by Moab. And the king of Moab, Balak, he's looking down, seeing all these people. I mean, there's over 1 million of them. There might have been as many as 2 million Israelites. And he's looking down from the mountaintop. These guys might take over my whole country. What am I going to do? I know what I'll do. I'm going to hire the prophet Balaam to come and curse him. I hear he's a real prophet. I'll hire him. And so he goes and gets Balaam and brings him there. And Balaam wants the dough. He wants the money. But God says to him, you can only say what I tell you to say. And he tells that to Balak. Though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not go beyond the word of the Lord my God to do less or more. And so Balaam's up there on the mountaintop looking down at him. They made a little altar for him. And Balak's there. Come on, curse him. Gets ready to speak. And he speaks a blessing. Balak's furious. They do it 4 times. I told you, I can only say what God tells me to do. Balaam wants the money. Balak wants the cursing. And so Balaam says, you know, I can't curse him for you, but I'll tell you what you can do. Send your women down there and get them to worship false gods. And then God will get mad at them and he'll judge them. And that's exactly what happened. It's a location, Baal of Peor. Mountain was Peor. And it says in Numbers 25, when the women came down and began to commit adultery with the men, they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, small g, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel was joined to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel. So here we have another example of Israel leaving God in favor of what they wanted to do. Let's go have sex with these women. We'll forget God. He won't notice, maybe. Think of where Israel came from. They had just kind of walking through the Sea of Aquila would be kind of impressive. The earthquakes and lightning and thunder coming out down from Mount Sinai and hearing God's voice, that would kind of impress me. That might be life-changing for me. Would it be for you? The manna falling on the floor of the wilderness every day? All those miracles that God has done for you, would that impress you? You would think it would have impressed them. Yet, with all that knowledge of God, they set him aside to go after the women. How sad. What a foolish, foolish choice. They became an abomination, just like the thing that they loved, which was these women worshiping the idols. So this is a big application point. Don't leave God for anything. Don't set him aside for any desire, want, thing that you want to do. Keep God in the focus. It starts with the desire, then it becomes a compromise, and then it becomes complete engulfment into the sin, and then we come blind. God's been set aside, and now we're blind to it. God's been replaced with our idol, whatever that might be. And it's sad. Verse 11, as for Ephraim, their glory shall fly away like a bird. Their glory was the blessing of being known as God's people. God's going to protect you. He's going to lead you into the promised land. You get all these benefits of being chosen by God, and that glory that they would brag about is going to fly away. The other nations knew that God had led Israel through the ocean. They knew that God had delivered them from Egypt. They had heard about all this. They were afraid of them. But now, hey, they're no big deal. God's left them. God apparently wasn't able to save them. And so what's going to start happening in Ephraim or Israel? No birth, no pregnancy, and no conception. Though they bring up their children, yet I will bereave them to the last man. Yes, woe to them when I depart from them. Just as I saw Ephraim like Tyre, planted in a pleasant place, so Ephraim will bring out his children to the murderer. So no birth, no pregnancy, pregnancy, thank you. How do I say it, Brian? No birth, no pregnancy, and no conception. This is Hosea's way of saying the population is going to decrease. You guys are diminishing. And even when you have children, God's going to bereave them to the last man. They're going to die young. Tyre, as you're supposed to say it, was located at a great spot on the ocean. It's kind of up farther, up around here on the ocean. And you have the Mediterranean Sea with all the goods by ships, and then you have all these continents and trade routes going through Israel and Tyre. Israel was located in a great location just like Tyre was. So you bring the goods and they travel through the country, but he's saying, you're located in a great location like Tyre, but pleasant place, but it's not going to do you any good. You're going to fall. Verse 14, give them, O Lord, what will you give? Give them a miscarrying womb and dry breasts. So again, continuing the decreasing theme. All their wickedness is in Gilgal, for there I hated them. Now Gilgal, interesting town, it was once the center of education where Elijah and Elisha would train the prophet's children. Now if you go over to Africa as a missionary, they'll have missionary schools, and then the parents will be out missionarying in the field while the kids are in the group school. Well, this is where the prophet's kids would go for education. Can you imagine studying under Elijah and Elisha? How cool that would be. Well, now Gilgal is the center for idolatry, and the false prophets are teaching there. And so it's become a hated place for God because of the evil of their deeds. I will drive them from my house. I will love them no more. All their princes are rebellious. Ephraim is stricken. Their root is dried up. They shall bear no fruit. Yes, were they to bear children, I would kill the darlings of their womb. My God will cast them away because they did not obey him, and they shall be wanderers among the nations. Now, Israel did indeed become a wanderer among the nations. Assyria took them in about 722, And not only would they take the people out of the land, but then they would bring other people and repopulate the land. So they totally wipe out the national identity. They're completely different people. Israel never really came back. They did wander back. And you hear about the story of the Good Samaritan or the woman at the well in Samaria? Samaria is where Israel wandered back. Many of them had intermarried. And so the other Jews would look at them and go, well, you're not really Jewish. You guys were hauled away captive. You intermarried. You came back. Can you really trace your bloodlines anymore? Jesus went and spoke to them, so apparently he received them. But Israel never really came back as formally as they did when Judah went to Babylon and then came back and rebuilt the temple. They remained more intact. So the consequences of setting God aside in our heart, God leaves us to our own devices. And then our relationship with God is ruined. We bear no fruit, got the dried up tree here. Life isn't fulfilling. We become dried up like that tree. We become wanderers like Israel was, wandering, no relationship with God, not knowing where they're going. That's a great picture of what happens to us when we pursue our sin and just keep pushing God away. I'm going to do what I want. I'll worry about you later. Now, as we go into chapter 10, we need a little understanding of the story of God's vineyard. Remember, there's two places in the Bible where we see God's vineyard. One is in Isaiah chapter 5. And it says that God dug out the stones, he planted the best vines, he built a tower. You'd build a tower to watch over your vineyard, you know. Oh, there's a fox. You get them. I guess foxes don't eat grapes. What eats grapes? They would shoot whatever, those grape eaters. And he was expecting lots of fruit, so he built a wine press. But despite all of that careful tending, his vineyard yielded wild grapes. So in that spiritual analogy, I've chosen these people. You're going to be my people. The grapes are the people. That's the fruit. You're going to grow in relationship with me, and you'll be a stronger nation. There'll be more, and we'll be in relationship. And the wild grapes are people that don't believe in God. They're not in relationship with God. I took Israel, and I'm trying to grow them, and they're not even mine. They don't even believe in me. They've gone sideways. They're wild grapes. So that's one story of a vineyard. And then when Jesus comes, he tells that same story, but he adds a little twist to it. And since he's God with flesh on, he gets to do that. It's in Luke chapter 20, where he hired men, or vine dressers, to tend the vineyard while he's gone. The vine dressers are the spiritual leaders, the religious leaders. Well, it's been a while. I'm going to send my servants to the religious leaders to get some of the grapes. And in this analogy, the grapes are believing people. The religious leaders are supposed to lead people to God. And so they get to the vine dressers. Hey, give us some of the crop. And they kill them. I'll send servants again. And they kill them. Finally says, I'll send my own son. Surely they'll respect him. And they killed the son. Of course, that's Jesus. And the vine dresser said, let's kill them and the inheritance will be ours. They wanted the people. They wanted the religious system. It was their power, their prestige. They weren't interested in the relationship with God and taking people and pointing them to God. They were interested in gathering for themselves. In both these instances, God wants the fruit. He wants the people. He wants us. He wants our hearts. So, chapter 10, verse 1. Israel empties his vine, means he picks all the grape. He brings forth fruit for himself. Same situation, isn't it? Instead of for God, he's bringing the fruit for himself. According to the multitude of his fruit, he has increased the altars. According to the bounty of his land, they have embellished his sacred pillars. They're bringing in the fruit, and they're using it to build pagan altars, and let's give it to the false gods. It's God's vineyard. And they're taking the fruit and giving it away to a false god. Imagine how the vineyard owner would feel. How would you feel if you grew a crop of alfalfa and the guy that you hired to come and cut it, cuts it up, bales it up, takes it home, feeds it to his horses? Kind of make you mad. Verse 2, their heart is divided. This is the problem. divided hearts. Is God first in your heart? Or are you first in your heart? Is what God wants first in your heart? Or is it what you want first in your heart? Our reason for living, the reason He created us, is so that we could have fellowship with Him and that we could bring Him glory. So are we living for that, or are we living to bring ourselves glory, satisfy our own desires? This is just a foundational problem. As Christians, if we want to be mature Christians, we need to ask God to grow us in this. The word divided is helag, which is the idea of divided, but also smooth or flattering. So you could say their heart is an insincere, smooth, and flattering heart. And isn't that just what happens when we convince ourselves that our sin's okay? You kind of feel that little twinge of guilt, and our heart is smooth and, you know, you're okay, and flattering, and talks us into it. Remember, our heart is deceptively wicked. It deceives us. We can't trust our heart. As we go into sin, our heart loves to just blind us. And that's what's going on with Israel here. And I see a lot of somber faces out here because we've all been there. Guess what? So have I. And we have a choice. When God is speaking to us, we push Him away, try to ignore Him. Maybe He won't see. Or we take the hard road and go, ouch, He's right. I don't like that He's right, but He's right. And I'm going to choose Him instead of me. That's a common situation that we're all faced with. And we're to get together and come to church to exhort one another in things like that. Come on, man. Live for the Lord. A little more. Let me beat this one to death. When we've convinced our sin is okay, we have a divided heart, we'll still often go to church. We even can say praise the Lord and have all of the Christian lingo. You ever had that where, you know, you just kind of see through it and it drives you nuts? You think, these people really even believe, but they've got all the lingo? Is it sincere? You got the Christian lingo, but where's your heart on Monday? Is it still with the Lord, or are you back into your own world? You know, we don't fool anybody when we do that, and it's sad. Now they are held guilty. So they've been doing this for a while, and God has been passive about it. Not because He doesn't see, and God does that with us. When we sin, there's no reaction, it seems like. He doesn't squish us because He's kind. His kindness is that He's waiting for us to turn and repent. That's His kindness. And that kindness should lead us to repentance. We realize God is overlooking that stupidity I'm doing, hoping that I'll turn around. But there comes a point where He says, okay, you have to reap the results of the path you've chosen. And so now they're held guilty. Israel has been doing this for about 400 years. Now they're held guilty. He will break down their altars. He will ruin their sacred pillars. For now they say, we have no king because we did not fear the Lord. And as for a king, what would he do for us? Now this is, he's broken down the pillars. Judgment has finally come. And they're saying, we realize we didn't look to God for our kings. We wanted our kings to be strong and build fortresses and defend us from Assyria. But now we've fallen because we didn't choose kings that God wanted. And you know what? If we had a king today, what could he do to protect us? He'd be powerless. He really couldn't save us. The light bulb's going off. They're going, oh, darn. It's too late now. They have spoken words, meaning the kings, swearing falsely in making a covenant. Thus judgment springs up like hemlock in the furrows of the field. Now I have no personal application for that one. I guess when they plow their field, hemlock would pop up. Now we plow our fields up at our house and wild oats pop up. In fact, if I wanted to grow a crop of wild oats, piece of cake. So they must have had the same problem with hemlock. Their judgment is springing up like hemlock. You just can't stop it. It's popping up everywhere. The inhabitants of Samaria fear. Samaria was the capital of Israel. because of the calf of Beth Avon. Remember, it used to be Bethel, which was the house of God. Beth Avon, God's changed the name of it to the house of deceit. Beth is house, Avon is deceit. For its people mourn for it, and its priests shriek for it, because its glory has departed from it. So he's prophesying here that the golden calf in Beth Avon is going to be destroyed, and that altar that they built is going to be destroyed. The idol, that golden calf, also shall be carried to Assyria as a present for King Jerob. Ephraim shall receive shame, and Israel shall be ashamed for its own counsel. So their idol that they're going to worship becomes spoil for their enemies. They're going to capture it and probably melt the gold down or something. As for Samaria, her king is cut off like a twig on the water. Now, they've had battles. Maybe they lose a city. Maybe they lose a region. But eventually, even the king of their whole nation is going to be like, you take the twig and you throw it in the water and it floats down the stream. It's just gone. History. Also, the high places of Avon. Remember what Avon means? We have Beth Avon, house of deceit. So the high places of deceit, the sin of Israel, shall be destroyed. On all the mountaintops, they'd build the Asherah poles and they'd worship the goddess of fertility and do pagan stuff there. So those high places are going to be cut off, wiped out. Destroyed. The thorn and thistle shall grow on their altars. They shall say to the mountains, cover us, and to the hills, fall on us. O Israel, you have sinned from the days of Gibeah. We talked about that, remember? There they stood, the battle in Gibeah against the children of iniquity did not overtake them. When it is my desire, I will chasten them. Peoples shall gather against them when I bind them for their two transgressions. He's going back to the Battle of Gibeah. And remember, all the nation came to wipe out the bad guys. And he's saying, there they stood, this battle. They're going to wipe out the children of iniquity, but they didn't overtake all the children of iniquity. You know why? The Israelites that came down to wipe them out, they had iniquity. They have to kill it themselves, kill all the people of Benjamin and then kill themselves if they're going to wipe out all the children of iniquity. And God's saying, when it's my desire, I'm going to take care of it. I'm going to take care of all those hearts, those individual hearts of iniquity. And the way he's going to do it is he's going to have peoples gathered against them. And he uses Assyria for the northern 10 tribes, and he uses King Nebuchadnezzar for the southern 2 tribes. The two transgressions, interesting. What we've read, and it doesn't tell us here precisely, but if we look at the context of Hosea, the two transgressions are one, departing from God, and two, going after something else, going after the other idols. Ephraim is a trained heifer that loves to thresh grain. You got the cow, the farm animal, and you train it. It's a work animal. It does lots of things. What it really likes to do is thresh grain, because as it walks around in the circle, pulling the stone, it can bend down and eat. If you take it out to plow, it doesn't get to eat. You guys have ridden horses. If you're out on the trail, what does he always want to do? Reach down and grab some grass. They like that. So Ephraim's a heifer, and they like this part of the work, eating the grain. But I harnessed her fair neck. I will make Ephraim pull a plow. Judah shall plow. Jacob shall break his clods. So God's going to make them learn to do the other work that leads to the threshing floor. It's not quite as much fun, but it's necessary. Those are the points of relationship with him. He mentions Judah again, which they're going to be, of course, hauled away in about 150 years. And he mentions Jacob. That's interesting. We haven't seen that before. And this could be a reference to all the 12 tribes of Israel as a whole. Verse 12. Sow for yourselves righteousness. This is an action on our part. Sowing is actually a labor. We're throwing the seed out. Okay? We're choosing to be fruitful. We're choosing to be obedient. Choosing God in our heart instead of something else. When we sow righteousness, there's a cause and effect. We reap, what does it say? Mercy. We need mercy because we don't do very well at sowing righteousness. But if that's our intent, God looks at us. All right, I'm going to give you back mercy. You're trying. Your heart is mine. break up your fallow ground. Now, fallow ground is ground that's not been worked. It's hard, it's resistant, it's stubborn. And this is God's illustration of our hard, resistant, stubborn heart when we've not been following him for a time. Break up your fallow ground, for it is time to seek the Lord till he comes and rains righteousness on you. Interesting little verse we've got here. We break up our fallow ground, our hard, hardened heart. We break that up by seeking the Lord. He changes our heart when we seek him, when we invite him in. Our heart is hard, but he'll change that. He'll plow it up. Now, sometimes it hurts when he plows it up, but he will plow it once we give him permission to come in and start that work. He says, for it is time. Don't wait. Time's now. Israel, you're about to be hollowed. Break up the fallow ground now. Maybe I can have mercy on you for a little longer. Don't wait, because judgment's coming. And that goes for all of us. Don't wait. The result is God's going to rain his righteousness upon us. I love this verse. He's gifting us his righteousness. We're to sow righteousness before. If we sow our own righteousness, we don't have any. But if God gives us his righteousness, it's amazing that he changes us like that and gives us his righteousness. So when he looks at us, we're clean before him. For 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21, listen to this. For he made him who knew no sin, meaning Jesus, to be sin for us, that we might become the righteousness of God in him. That's not my works. That's not my righteousness. God's giving me his righteousness. How incredible is that? Romans chapter 5, verse 17. For if by the one man's offense death reigned through the one, much more those who receive abundance of grace and of the gift of righteousness will reign in life through the one, Jesus Christ. Gift of righteousness. When we believe in Jesus Christ, that he died for us, paid for our sins, and rose again, God gives us Jesus' righteousness. From the heavenly perspective, we stand before God righteous. Our works don't help that. Now, our works can be pleasing to God, but we're already righteous in his sight. We're already saved. But verse 13, you have plowed wickedness. Instead of sowing righteousness, you've plowed wickedness. This is we're seeing the opposite of that earlier verse. You've plowed wickedness, you have reaped iniquity, that cause and effect. You have eaten the fruit of lies because you trusted in your own way in the multitude of your mighty men. I have three lines here. First thing is, they believed the lie. They believed what they were told, the false truth about God. They believed it. Second thing, they trusted their own way. Anybody ever try to do that? Anybody not try to do that? But when we're in a relationship with God, if he's our what and Savior? Lord. What does Lord mean? Master. He's the master. He's the boss. So we're not going to trust in our ways anymore because we belong to him and he's our master. If we're in a relationship with God, we're trusting his ways. Even sometimes when they don't seem to make sense. But these guys trusted their own way. It's okay, God. I got this one. I know no one in here has ever done that. In the multitude of your mighty men, meaning my strength. I've got my mighty men here. They're going to defend me. And as long as you want to defend yourself, God will let you. And that's the problem, because he does a much better job of defending you. Three key verses here. We believe in the lie, trusting in ourselves, trusting in our own strength. It's the essence of all sin. As a result, verse 14, this is what comes next when we trust in ourselves and trust in our strength and believe the lie. Therefore, tumult shall arise among your people, and all your fortresses shall be plundered. You trust your own way, you get tumult. You trust your fortresses, you get plundered. As Shalman plundered Beth Arbel in the day of battle, a mother dashed in pieces upon her children. Now, we don't really know where Shalman was or Beth Arbel. It's not really clear. But apparently, there were some battles there that they lost badly. And the audience, Hosea's audience, would know exactly what he's talking about. But this is an example. You're trusting in yourselves, you're gonna be toast. Just like those places were that became toast, that were trusting in themselves. Thus it shall be done to you, verse 15. O Bethel, the same way as those battles. Because of your great wickedness, at dawn the king of Israel shall be cut off utterly. So not only is Israel going to suffer a great defeat, but even their king is going to be totally gone. There's no government left, no national identity left. And that's the end of chapter 10. We're going to stop there and pick it up in chapter 11 next week. But for application, I wrote down a couple of things that I would like to suggest. One is that first point, don't leave God for other things. Don't set him aside in your heart so you can pursue things you know he doesn't like. A great question as you're doing things is, what is God's heart about this? You know, should I take this job or that job? Should I pick this person as my girlfriend or boyfriend? Or should I, you know, go do this, follow this path or that path? Well, what's God's heart? What's God's heart in that? When you bring that into the equation, it can really make things clear. Unless, of course, your heart wants something else, then you tend to shove them away. Once you set God aside, Romans chapter 1 teaches us, we become futile in our thoughts. Remember, these people knew God, but chose not to glorify him and set him aside and went after what they wanted. Once you do that, you become futile in your thoughts. Our foolish hearts are darkened. We're given up to uncleanliness in the lusts of our hearts. Our hearts are given up to vile passions and a debased mind to do things which are not fitting. Before, we never would have done them. But now, if we've gone down the path, we're going, well, that's not so bad after all, maybe. And worst of all, we become blind to our sin. It's a bad path. And it starts so gently. And then you end up in total disaster. The essence of our sin is expressed back in 10:13 that we just looked at. You've eaten the fruit of lies. You trusted in your own way. And you trusted in your own strength. And so my summary is, you guys have heard this, let go, let God. Let go of what you want. Let God be in charge. Or die to your flesh and live to him. And no divided minds. Let's not be divided. Let's not be uncooked pancakes. When we're here and we love God and we're at church, that's awesome. But tomorrow, if we're all in the world and we don't even think about God and we're just doing what we want, God's not really in the picture. Yeah, I know about him, but I'll visit him again on Sunday. That's an uncooked pancake. And the God side is the raw side because there's no attention given to it. We'll stop there, pick it up chapter 11 next week. Father, thank you for your love and your patience.